Today's the 18th of May 2008. We continue with the second part of the lesson number 4 about the history of Buddhism in Vietnam. A continuous part in the end. Before we begin the lesson, we pray to the Buddha 3 times. Namo Bonasu Thikka Mauni Phat. Namo Bổn Sư Thích Ca Mâu Ni Phật. Nam Mô Bổn Sư Thích Ca Mâu Ni Phật. Last time we have studied the history of Buddhism in Vietnam during the Li Dynasty. And we have learned that most of the time in the past, Buddhism in Vietnam was very advanced and promoted by the kings, except for a couple of years. Now we continue with the Trần Dynasty. You remember that the Li Dynasty was the best part for Buddhism. Now the Trần Dynasty has also some part, some good part, but it didn't last too long, like the Li. If you understand the history of Vietnam, you know that the Trần first usurped the power of the Li. The last Li king were very weak, and some Trần Mandarin, that is officials, they tried to control them. And the last one was the one with like a small girl who was promoted to become queen. One of the officials, Trần Thủ Độ, he's very sly. He got her married to one of his nephew and made the nephew king, the first king of the Trần Dynasty. Because if he become king, people will say that he usurped the power. But if the queen abdicates her husband, that's natural. So the first king, Trần, was like not very good. But in terms of Buddhism, this Trần king promoted Buddhism. Buddhism under Trần Dynasty from 1225 to 1400. So that is about like 175 years. But during this time, only about 50 years was good for Buddhism. Overview of Buddhism during Trần Dynasty. Inheriting advances under Li Dynasty, the first Trần kings, being learned and practicing Buddhism, and further development of Buddhism during the first 50 so years. Like we just said, the official, the Mandarin who kicked out the Trần was also one of the officials under the Li. And since the Li king were very fervent Buddhist, the Trần used to be Buddhist also. So the first Trần king being learned and practicing Buddhist and further development of Buddhism during the first 50 so years, then stopped it and pushed back. Then they stopped with Buddhism and pushed it back. Why? Two reasons for it. First, competition of Confucianism and resulting laicization of Buddhists. First reason, the Confucianism. Confucianism is not a religion. It was considered also a religion, but mostly it was a philosophy of life. In fact, it controlled the civil life, the official life in Asia at the time. That is Vietnam, Korea, Japan, and China. Confucianism control. That is the moral. That is philosophy of life. So people follow this, follow Confucianism. In fact, Confucianism does not compete with Buddhism. But the problem is with the philosophy. Philosophy of Confucian. It is based on the order, on orderly life. So the kings like it. Because once you follow that, you always respect the father, always respect the king, you wouldn't dare to do anything against the rulers. So the rulers like it and try to impose it on people. Of course, this is good for the control of the country, but sometimes it impedes with the advancement of the countries because people cannot speak up. In fact, nobody couldn't speak up. And the power of the head household, of the head of the household, of the king, of the official, was like omnipotent. They can kill you, they can do anything to you. You have just to obey. was against the moral of Buddhism, because first thing in Buddhism we think that people were equal, because they all have a Buddha nature, and the monks are not supposed to bow to the king, which is against the rule in Confucianism. So basically, you know, Confucianism, you know, did not fight back against Buddhism. But due to the difference in philosophy, these, you know, we try to compete with each other. That is, you know, people who follow Confucianism try to belittle Buddhism. So they say that, well, if you just follow Buddhism, you will stop the advancement of the countries. You will make rebellion. So competition of Confucianists, and in fact, you know, all the official was Confucianists. Some of the officials, you know, can become Buddhists, but then usually, you know, they practice only Buddhism at home. And the resulting laicization of Buddhists, that is, you know, once the official were Confucianists, they try to impose their view. That is, you know, there must be order. So the temples, you know, must be also in order. That is, the king, the official, you know, will appoint the abbot, the head of monastery, and things like this. So the monks, you know, will go under the control, will go under the power of the officials. That is, you know, if once the official gave out some order, they will have to follow them. So resulting laicization of Buddhists, this, that is, many monks will try to please the officials, and the bad monks, you know, will suffice. That is, you know, the one who follow the orders, if the officials were bad, because if there was good officials, Buddhism will be promoted. If the officials were bad or against Buddhism, the one these officials favor will be the bad monk. So resulting laicization of Buddhists. The second reason for it is the decadence due to esotericism and formation of monk soldier during Fade. Decadence means the fall due to esotericism. Once, you know, you go on the web or you try to learn more about Buddhism, you see them calling something like esoteric Buddhism. Esoteric Buddhism means something beyond Buddhism or at the side of Buddhism. What does it mean? These are the practice which some people discuss and think that probably, you know, the Buddha didn't teach it or didn't really teach it that way. That is like some people like you, you know, you see people do something like Amani Padme Hum, things like that. And you think that, well, this is something you don't understand. So probably the Buddha didn't taught that. That's what we call by esotericism. That is some like a powerful things or something. Some people believe that it was not taught by the Buddha. Like you see, Buddhists do believe in all the sentient beings. Besides the humans, we have the animals. Animals, we see them. But the hungry gods, you don't see them. The asura, you don't see them. The deva, the gods, you don't see them. So some people think that, well, since I don't see them, they don't exist. They say that, well, some people who pray to the gods, you know, who give out the food, give out alms to the hungry gods or to the sentient beings, are just like crazy. And they call them practicing esotericism. Usually, you know, Buddhists do practice esotericism, because we do believe that, you know, we can transmigrate. That is, you know, be reborn as an animal, be reborn as an asura, hungry gods, or someone like, or some other sentient beings. So they do exist. The fact that we don't see them does not mean that they don't exist. Usually, we practice a little only. We mix them with the sutra reading and with other things. Some people, you know, try to promote esotericism. That is, you know, they think that, well, you practice only this. You just sit down and then you recite this mantra 100,000 times, and your body will become invisible. And people do believe in it. So that was really bad. That's why we call them decadence. If you believe it without any proof, that will become like something false, something wrong. and formation of monk soldier during payday, that is against the rule of Buddha. Monks are not supposed to kill people to become soldier. But during this king payday, he draft every monk. He draft the monks and make them soldiers to fight against the Champa. Because they think that, well, many young men, you know, just became monks like this, and he liked some soldier. So he say, go, become soldier, go fight, kill some people in Champa, and then you can go back and practice again, become monk again. So that was bad, because people, you know, had the bad idea about the monks then. Overview of Buddhism during the Chan Dynasty, you see that the Chan inherited from the Li, so they practiced Buddhism also, but it was good only for about the first 50 years or so. Now, the most influential Chan kings in Buddhist propagation, the three kings, King Chan Taiton, Chan Nanton, and Chan Angton. The first king, Chan Taiton was the first king, Bok Chan Kang, fervent Buddhist, Biên Temple, wrote some books, especially Thiền Tông Chỉ Nam and Khóa Huy Lục. I gave you the English translation of it, Vat Me Kum for Dhyana. Thiền Tông Chỉ Nam, Vat Me Kum means follow me. This is Latin, Vat Me Kum means follow me. That is some book, some instruction, so you can follow, but you call them Vat Me Kum. Like, you know, when I was a student, usually we try to get some books, some Vat Me Kum, because it is like condensed for. If you read the textbook, it is too vast, too big. You don't know where to go. But Vadimikum means that they just, you know, condense some part in some part, some instruction, follow easily. So that's what they call them, the Vadimikum. Dhyana, you should understand it already, because we have learned about it. Dhyana means concentration. Dhyana, in Vietnamese, they call them thiền, or they translate it to dig. But dig does not mean much. But thiền is better. Thiền means that. Vadimikum means that instruction for dhyana, for concentration, for the practice of concentration. And Khóa Huy Lục means instruction on emptiness. Khóa Huy Lục is a collection of koan. Some people who read about Zen, in Zen, you know, there are different schools in Zen, different way of practice in Zen. And one way of the practice is through meditating on the koan. In Chinese, they call them the huatu. That is, the master will give you some work, and then the student must meditate on it. They call them koan. Koan means public record. That's it. Because this is taken from public record. Like a koan, like a, you go to master and say, master, I want to get enlightenment. He say, what is the sound of one hand clapping? You say, what? And then, go. You just go back to your place, whatever, you do whatever, and then you just meditate on it. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Easy, right? You got easy. Two hand clapping. Now, one hand clapping. Right? Easy. Master, I know, one hand clapping. What? Woo! She sleep on the head. Say, go back, meditate more. What? Say, not that way. You say, don't do that. Say, master, sound of one hand clapping? Nothing, nothing. Wait, okay, bye. We did take more. You keep on doing this. Whatever he answers, he will get some shit stick on the head. No, whack him with the shit stick and then go back, meditate more. Until he realized. Why does he have to meditate on this? Because this question, you know, does not need to be answered by intelligence. If you use your brain to answer it, see, like this one is what we call by concrete thinking. That's a sign of schizophrenia. Yeah, people who answer like that, you know, is schizophrenic. Because this figuratively speaking, you see it? It's like, you know, some people say that, well, why did they say the dog who bark, you know, don't bite? Say, easy, because the one who bark and bite, you know, will bite their tongue. Right? But that's concrete thinking. They don't mean that. So, you see, Koan meditation is very high, very powerful. Don't take it lightly. So you see, understand that this instruction of emptiness is a collection of Vietnamese koan. Because some people think that Vietnamese don't have koan, only Chinese or Japanese. Vietnamese did have koan, but it was not really spreading out. You know why? Because they don't speak English, right? If you don't speak English, nobody understands you. Japanese, they translate them into English. Chinese, they translate them into English. So people in the world understand them. Vietnamese people, they don't want to speak English. They don't want to translate to English. People ignore them. So it will be your duty to translate them into English. Now we continue. So the first one with Trần Thái Tôn was a fervent Buddhist, and he built a lot of temple, and he wrote two books. Of course, you know about this book later. If you read the Vietnamese, you see the history of Vietnamese Buddhism. Trần Thái Tôn is the third kid. Why? Because the second thing, Trần Thái Tôn, he was good, but he was not really practicing Buddhism a lot. What he did is to do the war against the Mongol. You remember during this period, the Mongol invade Vietnam. The Mongol invade China first. And in fact, they invade China. And they established the Nguyên dynasty, Nguyên. But when they went to Vietnam, they were pushed back. First, by Hưng Đạo Vương Trần Quốc Tuấn, who is one we say later in here, the Trung Thượng Sĩ and the like, under Trần Thái Tôn. And then the second one, Trần Thánh Tôn, he didn't practice much of Buddhism. He just continued something under his father. But Trần Nhân Tôn, the grandson of Trần Thái Tôn, that is the third king. He practiced Buddhism a lot. And he was very renowned because under Trần Nhân Tôn, you remember there was the Hội Nghị Diên Hồng, the Diên Hồng Conference, which is like the first referendum. That is the first democratic referendum in Vietnam. You remember in the time, it was a monarchy. The king was all-powerful. But under Trần Nhân Tôn, he established the Hội Nghị Diên Hồng before he fought against the Mongol. He said, well, some official in the country say that, well, king, the Nguyên has invaded China. They are too powerful. Now they even push the China down to invade us. And we are a small country. We fight back against them, probably we will be like erased. So I advise you to just say, we become your vassal. We pay you something every year. Let us control our country. We recognize your sovereignty. And some officials say, no, we have to fight back against them. So the king then decided and said that, well, so in that case, let the people decide. It was not a democracy, but somehow he established this referendum. So now if you read about the history of Vietnam, you heard the word Hội Nghị Diên Hồng. He invited all the elder of the country. That is, each village sent some elderly people, go over there and meet over there and then just vote on fight or no fight. That was the first referendum in Vietnam. So Vietnam was a very good country. It was not too bad. But the problem with them is that they take pride in their culture, in their personalities too much. They must mix with people in the world because they belong in the world. It is not because you think that you are number one, that you are number one. Even if you are number one. So Trần Nhân Tôn, he was very good. He abdicated after defeating the Mongol. So you see, after this Hội Nghị Diên Hồng, he fought back against the Mongol, and of course the Mongol was rushed back. Because the most important thing is the spirit. If all the people are united against something, nobody can do anything. Then, after he defeated the Mongol, he abdicated and he went to the Yên Tử Mountain and he found the Trúc Lâm School. That is the first Vietnamese Buddhist school. Being temple gave Dharma talk and medicine, medicine wine, because he did a good thing, donation to poor people. Transmitted, we have land here. Transmitted to Pháp Loa. Pháp Loa is a monk and died at Ngọc Vân temple. We learn about Pháp Loa later. Pháp Loa is a monk. So Trần Nhân Tông was the founder of this, the first patriarch of the Trúc Lâm school. Now we have a new school. We have the Vũ Nguyên Thông, Ngô Thảo Đường, Vinay Thao Rúc Chi, you remember that? The three school. Now we have the Trúc Lâm school, the fourth. Trần Anh Tôn is the fourth Trần Kim, disciple of Pháp Loa. Fervent Buddhist like his father, and he brought Tripitaka from China. So you see that in under Trần Anh Tôn, he made peace with China. Because China want to invade Vietnam. You remember under the Nguyên, they went, they tried to invade Vietnam. But then Trần Anh Tôn pushed them back. So they make peace of them and organize ceremonies and food distribution. The Trúc Lâm Yên Tử School, Trúc Lâm Tuệ Sĩ, Tuệ Trung Thượng Sĩ, the monks, the renowned monks, Trần Quốc Toản, son of Hưng Đạo Vương, Tuệ Trung Thượng Sĩ was one of the monks. Son of Hưng Đạo Vương Trần Quốc Tuấn fought against Mongol, then retired as disciple of Thiều Giáo, last patriarch of Vũ Nguyên Thông. Hưng Đạo Viên Vương Trần Quốc Tuấn, if you know, Hưng Đạo Viên Trần Quốc Tuấn was like a cousin of Trần Thái Tông, and he organized and fought during the first war against the Mongol. And Trần Quốc Toản was young at the time. And one of the fable about him, the story about him is that whenever he heard about the Mongol trying to invade Vietnam, he had an orange in his hand. And he was so angry, you know, he squeezed the orange without anything, any squeezer. He made juice with his own hand. One hand, not two hands. Son of Hưng Đạo Viên fought against Mongol, then retired as disciple of Thiều Giáo, last patriarch of Vũ Nguyên Thông. So Tuệ Trung Thượng Sĩ was one of the disciples of Thiều Giáo. Thiều Giáo was the last monk in the lineage of Vũ Nguyên Thông. Later on, you know, Vũ Nguyên Thông disappeared in Vietnam. Respect by Thánh Tôn. Thánh Tôn is the second king who entrusted Nhân Tôn to him. That is, Nhân Tôn is the son of Thánh Tôn. So Tuệ Trung Thượng Sĩ, he's Trần Quốc Toản, he's the uncle. He's uncle of Trần Thánh Tông. So he is the great uncle of Trần Nhân Tôn. So Thánh Tôn, that is his nephew, gave him his son to be taught. So when he practiced Buddhism, he became Tuệ Trung Thượng Sĩ. And one of the disciples of the last disciple of the Vũ Nguyên Thông. Trần Nhân Tôn is the first patriarch of Trúc Lâm. We just learned about him. His name, if you look in the book, is Điều Ngự Giác Hoàng. Điều Ngự Giác Hoàng. In the time of the monks, although they become monks, they like to have the fame, the power, the name, and everything. Điều Ngự Giác Hoàng. The third one is the Pháp Loa Master. The Pháp Loa is the monk who been transmitted by Trần Nhân Tôn, the second patriarch. So he's second patriarch. So he's disciple of Trần Nhân Tôn. He was born from Hải Dương. At 20 years old, he met Nhân Tôn, the king, became disciple, because the king, Trần Nhân Tôn, after he defeated the Mongol, he abdicated, and he went to the Yên Tử Mountain and founded this school of Buddhism, Trúc Lâm, remember that. At 25 years, that is 4 years later, he gave a talk at Siêu Lai Temple, then was bestowed Yên Tử Temple in his Sangha, so he was very smart. He became disciple at 21 years, and at 25 years, only in 4 years, he was entrusted by Trần Nhân Tôn and gave him like an abbot of this monastery, big monastery. And during his lifetime, which is short, he died at 47 years old. But during this short life, like a 26 year, he built 1,300 statues, 5 stupas, 200 monasteries, and certified 15,000 monks, and wrote 2 books. Certified to 15,000 monks. In that, he organized the precept platform, like the one here for the Bodhisattva. The precept platform is the meeting of the monks and of the people who want to become monks. During this kind of ceremony, that he can certify the monks. The Huyền Quang Master is also very renowned. He is the third patriarch, that is, disciple of Pháp Loa. He was born in Bắc Giang. He was ugly but smart, very ugly. But then, you know, he was very, very smart. So when he study and he passed the exam, become official, a lot of people, you know, gave out their daughter to him. Because he became very renowned there, but he refused everyone, including the princess, and become official through exam. And he went to China as ambassador once, and when he come back, you know, he retired. He's renounced from the official life. And become disciple of Pháp Luân, gave talk in Biên Temple, like the previous one. Now, so under the Trần dynasty, you see that, after the Trần Anh Tôn, you see, who end in 1340. The Trần dynasty end in 1400. So during like something like more than 80 years, we didn't hear much about them. There are many other kings, but most of these kings were really not good. They either, you know, were of short life, or work only as a figure. That is, all the officials, you know, took care of the matter of the country. So during the first like 50 years like this, more than 50 years, Buddhism under the Trần, you know, was good, and later on was not. Until the Trần, you know, was kicked out by the Ho. The Ho Quý Ly. Ho Quý Ly was the grandfather of the last queen of Trần. You see, because many of these Trần kings, once, you know, they become impregnated with the Buddhism, they don't want to get too many children. They study that, and then they think that, well, getting too many children, you know, means that you have too many karmas. So they don't want to. But as a king, and if you don't have a son, some people, you know, will try to kill you. The reason kings, you know, have many wives, is that because they want many sons. And these sons, you know, will take care of all the things in the countries. Like one son become like premier, one son become like the general, one son become like that. So it's like the family things. But now if the kings don't want to have children anymore, he will fall. So you see it under the Ho. Not too long, you see, 1400 to 1407. Just a couple of years. And then the later Lê. Later Lê means that the descendant of the old King Lê research. I mean, social. This part is the darkest period of Vietnam Buddhism due to progressive decline from last Trần King through later Lê. After the short reign of Ho, the Chinese Ming invaded, destroyed books and temples, promote Taoism, esoteric, Buddhism and Confucianism, which were picked up during later Lê. That is, during the Ho. When the Ho usurped the power of the Trần, the Chinese Ming invade Vietnam, saying that, well, we just want to restore the Trần. Trần was an official king, and you are usurpation. So then we need, you know, to kick you out. We just come, you know, to establish the old king. So they have good excuse. But when they came to Vietnam, then the excuse was no more good. Because the soldier was poor, right? They came in and then, whoa, this is good. Hey, give it to me. You don't give it to me, cut off your head. You can get it, right? So the Ming came to Vietnam and they ransacked it. Really, ransacked it. So the Lê have been re-established. But then, you know, the Ming state become like the controller. They are not invader. They were invited by the Lê. So-called. So, but when they come, and you remember the Ming at the time, you know, in China, the Buddhism under the Ming, you know, also declined. That is, you know, they promote a lot of Taoism. Taoism is like Buddhism, but they practice to become like fairies. You understand what I mean? People who practice Taoism, usually they want to become like immortal. They call them immortals. So you see the Qin Shi Huang, he built on these tombs, you know, and he buried these peoples because he tried to do something according to Taoism, that if he did it, he will stay immortal. Of course. See it? So immortality was like associated by people at the time. And most of the Taoists, you know, practice that. Practice on these. You know the Pat Wai, The thing that we see people put up on the front door, the parkway, the eight diagrams with the three stripes, you know, three broken stripes and three things like this, they call them the parkway. Parkway, you know, was like the magic from Lao Tzu. He invented that, you know, to hold things here and to make the medicine which make you become immortal. You remember when you read the monkey? Have you read the monkey story? The monkey told Ngô Không, they think the time. This monkey, you know, was like caught and then put in the parkway control, big one like this. You remember that? Well, what I mean, you see, that Taoism is like this. Esoteric Buddhism, we just learned, and Confucianism, which were picked up during lately. So the real, the Makoi, the original Buddhism, were like ignored, mostly. That is, you know, you practice for deliverance. You don't practice anymore. You practice to get something, to get immortality, to get some power, to become invisible, or to get fame, or to get something like this. So, which were picked up during lately. So that is why, you know, the master said that it was the darkest period of Vietnamese Buddhism. Now, during the lately, you see the history, we have this picture, right? You see the mark, the train and the wheel. The mark, you know, was all the way up from north. The mark, you know, was the official who claimed that they protect the land. They protect the land. And then the Trinh and the Nguyen were official, the overlords, who also claimed that they protect the land. But the Mark Dang Dung, the Mark, one of the one, you know, who controlled the north, and at first he was really mean, and he killed the founders of the Trinh and the Nguyen family. So the Trinh and the Nguyen family, you know, run away to the south, along with some king, lay king also. And all these two, Trinh and Nguyen, they claim that they protect the king lay. So you see that? We have three parts, the Mark, the Trinh, and the Nguyen. All of them proclaim that they protect the lay king. But of course, you know, they just won the power for their own. After a couple of years, two or three kings, the Mark up north, and the Nguyen disappear, leaving only the Trinh and the Nguyen, the Trinh to the north and the Nguyen to the south. These are the two overlords. This division will last like 250 years. Now, Buddhism during the north and south division, from 1528 to 802, that is more than 250 years. Because the first one, you know, were divided in three parts, not only north-south only. There was also the Mark. But after a while, you know, the Mark disappeared. So we're left with the Trinh and the Nguyen. Later, Lay Queen Chiêu Hoàng was usurped by Mark family. So the Mark, you know, controlled the Lay family. And they claimed that they protect the Lay king, although, you know, they controlled the countries. At that time, you know, there was many strong, powerful family. It's like the Shogun time in Japan. So these shoguns, I mean, these overlords, we call them overlords, because they are smaller lords. Yeah, these overlords. Very good. You see, this is spread all over the world. This concept, you know, of shogun, overlord, spread over the world. That happened in Japan, that happened in Vietnam, that happened in Europe, everywhere. Usurped by Ma family, the Lay ran south for protection of Trinh overlord. The Trinh claimed that they protect, and who chased the Nguyen overlord for the south. So the Nguyen, when they run away like that, they kick out the chamber. Of course, they can't do anything. They have to kick out the chamber first. So they expand the countries. When relatively settled, these overlords both took Buddhism as official religion and compete for monks and building new temples. Why? Because you see, Vietnam, you know, used to be only in the north. Now they expand to the south. Champa, you know, was some Buddhist and mostly Hindu. You remember that, right? Champa country, mostly Hindus. So, well, they come in the new countries, they don't have temple, they don't have monks. So they try to build temples. They try to get some old monks. But then there was not many monks because young people was like drafted to become soldier already. So they import the monks from China. Many monks from China, Ming and things. In the meantime, China was also in turmoil. So many monks left and came settled in Vietnam. Now Buddhism under the Qing overlord. Under Lê Thế Tôn, that is the kings which the Qing kept, like the Queen Bee. They kept this king like the Queen Bee to proclaim that they are like the real McCoy, the one who protect the Lê. The Chinese monk Hồng Giác Thủy Nguyệt learned from Nhất Cú Chi Giáo. These are all Chinese. Transmit the Tao Đạo school to Hoè Nhai Temple. That is now in Vietnam, in Hanoi, Vietnam. If you come to Hanoi, this temple still exists. And this temple has one peculiar statue. It's very old. It's the statue of the man kneeling down and holding the Buddha on his back. The French at the time, they came and they didn't understand that. So they say that, well, this is the Thang Mai Do Phat. That the savage carried up the Buddha. But it was not. The statue was built by the King Lê Hy Tôn. Lê Hy Tôn, 1676-1705. He commits some sins, which is like, he kicked out many monks. So then later on, when he met with the many bad things, he was taught by one monk that, well, since he did some bad karma, now he tried to buy them back. So he ordered some people to carve his picture in one piece of wood. That is one big trunk of tree like this. A picture of him kneeling down like this, all the way down. And then on his back was a big statue of the Buddha. On them, the king carried the Buddha. Now, if you come to Vietnam, you still see that statue. This is very old, you see? That is like old and very historical. So Hoè Nhai, and now you see that Vietnam has the Tao Động school. Tao Động in Soto Zen. Tao Động. In the time, you remember the story history of Vietnam, we didn't have the Tao Động school. Tao Động was really transmitted from Bodhidharma. That is, just sit down. So the Chinese monk Hồng Giác, he was from China. And when he was from China, he learned from Nhất Cú Chi Giáo. Nhất Cú Chi Giáo is one of the monks from the lineage of Bodhidharma. And he went to Vietnam, and then he go to Hanoi. You see, number two is Hanoi. You see, number two is small in the area of the Mark, in Hanoi, school of Hoè Nhai. So he went over there and start this school. Under Lê Hy Tôn, the Chinese monk Lâm Giác and Nguyệt Quang transmit the Lâm Thế school to Liệt Phái, Lâm Thế in Rinh Giải. So you see, these two Zen schools start to appear in Vietnam in the same time. So, which we didn't have before, now we have them. The Qing overlords also requested Chinese Tripitaka. Biên Temple also welcomed Hương Hải Master, who was big master in South Nguyễn overlord country, but left for North due to Nguyễn suspicion. That is, in Qing overlord, you see that most of the monks under this area, renowned, if they are renowned, usually they were Chinese monks. But one of the monks was Hương Hải, Vietnamese monk. Hương Hải stayed in the South under the Nguyễn, and then somehow he was suspected by the Nguyễn kings to be like some spy or something. So then he ran away to the North, and he was welcomed by the Qing, and who built him temple, I think. So Hương Hải was a big master. And one of the stories is that the Qing also treat him very well, and built him big monastery, and asked an abbot in the monastery, he has some servant. We shouldn't call them as a servant. We call them attendant. Attendant. And whenever he eats, he doesn't eat alone. He doesn't eat with the assembly. He eats in his room, and the attendant would bring the rice, the meal to his room. And one day, the attendant brought the meal to his room, and somehow he tripped it, and he spilled some rice on the ground. Now the attendant was very from scared. He rushed down, you know, and tried to pick up this. And the master, the Huanghai master, saw it and said that, is it only because of some grain of rice that you have to stoop so low? And then he renounced everything and he went to the forest practicing alone. So he realized really, you know, he doesn't need all this stuff. Now Buddhism under the Nguyen Overlord, that is in the south. Fervent Buddhist, Nguyen Overlord, Faibor Buddhist monk, Biên temple statues also. Because you remember these overlords at the time, they had fame, they had money. So all they need now, you know, is some protection from the gods. Biên temple statue, many monks were welcome, especially Chinese. I explained to you why already. Nguyên Thiều master, Nguyên Thiều, Chinese monk, he was born in Canton. Quantum, nowadays Hong Kong, took vows at 19 years old and practiced at Bảo Tự Temple. In 1665, he arrived at Bình Định. In Thập Tháp, Bình Định. On the map, you see Bình Định, Quy Nhơn, Vijaya, nearly at the end of the Nguyễn country. Bình Định, Quy Nhơn, Vijaya, the town with the spot right here. This is all the way south. He arrived and being the Thap Jida temple, which still exists today. Taught disciples, then went to Thuận Hóa. Thuận Hóa means Huế nowadays. Nowadays we call it Huế. Huế, Phú Xuân. Because of some of these names, you know, disappear now. Then went to Thuận Hóa, Biên Đình Hà Trung temple, and Huế, Biên Đình Quốc Ân. It's the title they divide into. Brought back Thạch Liêm master. Thạch Liêm was one of master in all the monks, many sutra statues, instruments. That is, after he built all these, Nguyễn overall told him to go back to China, to Canton, and try to bring more sutras, more books, more instruments. Because like, you know, whenever you perform some liturgy, you need something. And some, like, you know, some small bells, some doji, some instruments, statues, and the Thạch Liêm master, along with all the master. Thạch Liêm was big. Master, Chinese master. Now the second one was the Liễu Quán. Liễu Quán, he's Vietnamese, but he studied only with Chinese somehow. Liễu Quán master named Lê from Phú Yên. You see Phú Yên? Phú Yên is the right here. You see the last part. Phú Yên, the last part. Was orphan of mother at 6 years, so he was given as disciple of Chinese monk Thevien. That is, his father still survived, but he couldn't take care of him. 7 years later, his master died. He went to Bảo Phước Temple in Huế, learned with Chinese Jack Hong master, then Thạch Liêm master. He participated in many precept platforms. That is, he transmitted the precept to many monks. Later, he came to Thiên Thai and Biên Thiên Tôn Temple. He died in 1742. So these two masters, Nguyên Thiều and Liễu Quán, if you come back to Vietnam in the south, or especially in the center of Vietnam, many temples and many monks claim that they descend from these. They belong to these. So after the division of these overlords, we come to the Nguyễn king, the Nguyễn, first, you know, the Tây Sơn first. If you learn about the history of Vietnam, the Tây Sơn, Quang Trung king, he fought back against all the Nguyễn and the Trịnh. The mark disappeared. So he fought against the Nguyễn and the Trịnh. He claimed that he protected the Lê king also, and then fought back against the Nguyễn and the Trịnh, so the people now follow him. And then he kicked back the Trịnh died, the Nguyễn king, you know, ran to France. Trịnh Nguyễn Bích Quang, he went to France and to Thailand. He went truthfully, you know, to Thailand, and he sent his son to France along with an evêque, a French evêque. So later on, you know, the importance of Catholicism in Vietnam. But at the time, it was like that. So Tây Sơn, Nguyễn Huệ unified the countries, but only for a couple of years. He died, and then his brother followed him, but was no being no good. His brother was not really that good. So the Nguyễn came back with the French, and then re-established the country. Buddhism during the first Nguyễn King. You remember this book was written in 1955, And in 1955, the King Bảo Đại was still king of Vietnam. King Bảo Đại was the last king of Nguyễn dynasty. So that was why, you know, you see that the master, you know, was very careful writing down about the king, the Nguyễn king, because if he wrote something wrong, you know. Buddhism during the first Nguyễn king, during the Taizong, although the kings hadn't reunited the country, they have destroyed many temples, burned sutra and men statues and bell making weapons. He was a good soldier, because when he tried to kick them out like this, some king, you know, came to China and asked for help. The Chinese, you know, came them down. But then, you know, the Vietnamese pushed them back. You remember the Hà Hội in Đống Đa, Hà Nội. In Hà Nội, nowadays you still see the Đống Đa, where they say that thousands of Chinese were killed over there. But how to make a weapon? All they could do, you know, is to melt the bell and things like this. So he destroyed many temples and everything. That's true. That was in the history. The first Nguyễn King tried to revive some temples, but Buddhist influence in the mass has eroded under the invasion of Occidental civilization and decadence of monkhood by materialism. Occidental means that the French mostly at the time. Master Thích Mật Thể wrote, the Sangha in the north still kept relatively the order and precepts. That is, they still respect the precepts and practice good. While in the center, many monks got married openly. That is, you know, they are just like people who take care of the temple. But they kept the head shaved, you know, and kept the robe, because without them, you know, they wouldn't get any money. So they have to keep them, although they are not monks anymore. And the south was worse, because most of people, you know, at the time, you know, they practiced the, what we call Taoism. They came to the mountains to practice, you know, immortality. And in fact, you know, a lot of people in Vietnam nowadays, you come in Vietnam and you can go to some temple and ask them for the amulet. Some monks, you know, will write you some amulet. Monk, master, I want to pass the test this time. What's your name? Okay, and then he used a piece of yellow paper and wrote this, hold, give it to you. So he said that, hey, you kept this in this, you don't eat any dog meat. Yeah, don't eat any dog meat. Beef was all right, I think that is. So you kept this amulet, you know, and hopefully, you know, you will pass the test. If you pass the test, you pay him. If you don't pass the test, you come back, hey, why didn't I pass the test? Hey, I told you to wear it in the right pocket. Oh, I did wrong. So things like this, right? So most monks only long for fame, asking for certification, knowing only to pray, to write amulets. You understand amulet, right? To be servants to officials, wealthy families. Another type were the one who got detached from society. That is the one who claimed that they really practice, enjoy pastime, and calling it deliverance. Enjoy pastime. That they just, you know, move around, you know, make some poems. They think that, well, they got deliverance. So the temples in the country became individual families, holding nothing of religious communion. That is, they don't form the Sangha anymore. Monks are not supposed to be in the Sangha. That is, in the congregation. Even lay people like us, we are supposed to be in communion, in the Sangha. We cannot practice alone. You cannot, you know, stay home and recite the precept. Have to get in touch with all the members. That is what we call a communion. And in fact, you know, in religion, if you are excommunicated, it's very bad. The community, you know, don't accept you anymore. That's bad. Conclusion. Buddhism has been present in Vietnam nearly 20 centuries. During this time, it has risen and fallen, mostly parallel to the country. It also stimulated the growth of intelligent and virtuous rulers, and inevitably sank the ruthless and inhuman ones. Thus, virtuous and tolerant rulers are a blessing for the country. Next time, we will learn about the revival of Buddhism. Chapter 21. Gần đêm công đức này hướng về khắp tất cả đệ tử và chúng sinh đều chọn thánh Phật đạo.